Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clarke and I'm welcoming in another new member of the book club. All the way from Japan, it's Ashley Baker. Ashley, welcome to the book club.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a great pleasure to have you, and I will ask you later on perhaps how you've ended up in Japan, living and working there. But before we do that, as a new member, we're going to go right back to your earliest comic memories, because I know there's a couple of comics along the way that you and I share an interest in. Tell us about your sort of comics and 2000 AD origin story.
Yeah, well, I suspect my comics origin story is very similar to many people. I started off with the Dandy. My parents were extremely keen to get me to read, and they wanted me to read everything and anything. So they encouraged me to read comics. And one day in the Dandy, I guess this was around about 1980 or so, when I was about 8 years old, there was an advert in the Dandy for a comic called Buddy, B-U-D-D-Y, Buddy comic. And this was like the next step up in the DC Thompson line of comics. And I stepped up. I graduated from the Dandy to the Buddy. And Buddy was black and white comic that was a lot of reprints from 1970s and the 1960s, and lots of familiar characters, probably to older readers, sports and war stories mainly. And I read that from issue one until it finished about 3 years later, when it was merged into the Victor comic, a very long-running comic. And I read the Victor from 1983 until it died in 1992, when around the same time, my dad said, they're bringing out a new version of The Eagle. And I didn't know what The Eagle was, but obviously it was a comic that he had read when he was a boy. So I was able to have two comics a week, the Victor and The Eagle. And so of course, they called it The New Eagle, but I didn't know The Old Eagle, so it was just The Eagle to me. And so I read The Eagle from the first edition right till the very end. And those stories in Buddy and Victor, and then The Eagle has stoked my love of comics since then. Buddy was very important because it was the first time I saw the art of Ian Kennedy.
Oh, right.
Yes. Yeah. Ian Kennedy drew a story called Frontline UK in Buddy, right at the end, before actually it cut off when Buddy died. But this was an invasion story, just like the titular invasion in 2000 AD. This was a Far Eastern, not a Russian Nazi invasion, but a Japanese Chinese Nazi invasion. And it was fought off by three or four guys in a tank, in a Scorpion tank, which seemed to have super powers of not being able to be destroyed by helicopters or airplanes or anything. And it would like duck into train tunnels and avoid enemy fire and stuff. And it was brilliant. And what I realized when the Eagle started, around the same time in 1982, was that, of course, Dan Dare was drawn after about issue 20 or so by Ian Kennedy. And, I was 10 years old, and I thought, I know that artist. That's a tank artist guy. And I realized then, comics didn't just like come out of a machine. They were written and drawn by actual people. And the idea of like an artist or a writer who could write on different comics, in different subjects and in different ways, that was quite a revelation.
And then along the way, was there some 2000 AD as well?
A little bit. I had a friend who read a bit, and But I had my allotment of two comics, and I didn't look to expand them. And I mean, I lived in the countryside in southeast England, and everything I bought was at the local newsagent, and they didn't, have any like American comics or anything particularly exciting. So I didn't have the capacity or the pocket money for a third comic. So I didn't. I didn't read 2000 AD or Battle or anything else. But when from time to time I would go to London, and I would go to Foyle's bookshop on the Charing Cross Road, and because they had a big comic section. And I enjoyed the comic section far more than, for example, Forbidden Planet, because Forbidden Planet was mostly American comics. And Foyle's had a big Titan, one of those big stands that rotate, and they had all the Titan collections of 2000 AD on there, and I have a very strong memory of standing there, not being able to buy them because they were too expensive, but I would stand there reading them in Foyle's, being a big bookshop full of people, that so no one would notice me. And I remember reading The Day the Law Died and thinking it was quite a wonderful story. A story that lasted for so long, so many episodes, and was so thrilling to read. But I didn't make the switch to 2000 AD until 1986 and Prog 500.
Which is a fair prog to jump on with, so that's fair enough.
Yes, I mean, it has the wonderful cover. That's what attracted me to it, the wraparound glossy cover. And it's... obviously, that's known as the golden age of 2000 AD around that time. I think around 350 to, I would say, 519 is the golden age of 2000 AD. And you've got Prog 501, well, actually Prog 500. You've got Bad Company. You've got a Nemesis to Warlock that's written Pat Mills and drawn by Brian Talbot. And Slain the King, which... in my opinion, is the best Slain, and the best art in Slain. It's quite incredible. And you've got a run of progs there, 501 to 505. You've got 501, the fantastic Bad Company cover. 502 is Kevin O'Neill with the Vark cover. Then 503 is a Brian Talbot Nemesis the Warlock cover. And then you've got a Carlos after that, because that's when Strontium Dog Bitch starts with the first appearance of Durham Red. And that, reading that to start off with, I mean, I was just gone. That was it. I was going to read nothing else apart from 2000 AD from that point. So I read the other things as well, but there was no way I was stopping. But I mean, that's when it all kind of came to a bit of a halt with Prog 520, because that was the first time they changed the prog for years, and they switched from the like the toilet paper newspaper to like glossy larger size comic, and just kind of lost a little bit in the art,
right?
Gained in clarity, lost in romanticism, maybe. I don't know what it was, but that's when things started to change in 520.
Well, at least you had, as you say, you've got a golden period of 2000 AD there for a while.
Yes, yes.
Now, we have got a 2000 AD story to talk about.
Yes.
And one that I've been waiting for somebody to pick so that I could go back and read the whole thing. Tell us what you've chosen for your visit to the book club today.
Right, so today I want to talk about Firekind by John Smith and Paul Marshall.
Indeed, lettered by Steve Potter, 2000 AD progs 828 to 840 were in 1993.
Yes.
Edited by Richard Burton with assistance by Alan McKenzie.
Yes.
Now, versions. You've got, have you got digital and the extreme edition?
Yes, I have, yes. Obviously, the stories you like, you have always end up with multiple versions of them. I've got the the extreme edition, which came out in 2005, and the digital edition, which came out a few years ago.
And I've managed to end up with both as well, Extreme Edition 8 and the Digital Edition on my Kindle.
Yeah.
It's also in the Ultimate Collection issue book number 82, which was in 2020, if you want a hardback version.
Yes.
When did you first encounter Firekind? Where did you read it first?
Right. Well, I read it in the progs. But what was happening was that I was at university at the time, and I was getting the progs delivered to my parents' home. So I was coming home in the holidays and reading big chunks of progs all in one go. And Firekind stood out particularly well because it's a story that probably better than, rather than single episodes, it really works as a whole unified story that if you read from start to finish, and as we'll talk about later, in the right order, it's quite a wonderful story with a wonderful plot progression that works better than a series of cliffhangers.
And it's interesting, if we jump ahead a bit, the introduction to the Extreme Edition by Alan Barnes does say that it reads spectacularly well.
Yes.
In a single sort of reading. Yeah. And we've got, three creators, if we include Steve Potter, but we've certainly got John Smith and Paul Marshall, possibly at the height of their 2000 AD powers, which we'll come back to.
Yes.
Tell us, what is the setup of Firekind? What is this story basically about?
Right, okay. this could get quite complicated, but John Smith is wont to do. But basically, you have a man called Hendrik Larsen, who is working as a scientist. I guess he's a planetologist. And he's working for a company called the Axis Charter Worlds. I don't know whether it's a company or like a federation type, planetary organization. But he's a government man in some way, and he suffered some sort of a personal loss, perhaps with the death of his father, and some sort of professional mistake that he's made in the past, and he's sent to a planet called a Genio Lael. I'm not too sure how you'd pronounce it, whether it's a hard or soft G, but he's sent to Genio Lael as kind of like a last, to try and make up for this mistake that he's made. He's told to study the local inhabitants and learn about the way they live. And he's told to register and record all the plants and animals that live on the planet. And when he gets there, he finds the planet is extremely dangerous. The atmosphere is poisonous, so he's got to wear a face mask. All the animals seem to be intent on killing and eating everything in their path. And there are bands of smugglers and human ne'er-do-wells who are trying to kill the local fauna and also kill anybody that tries to stop them. So he meets and becomes friends with some local inhabitants. Then the smugglers intervene and he is cast from the tribe, where he has to learn to live without his face mask. And then he has to combat these ne'er-do-well smugglers who try to gain information from him, and then finally to kill him and everyone around him. And on the way, we have some interesting points in the story, including some weird alien sex and some nasty violence and all sorts of things that John Smith is very keen about talking about.
Yes, indeed. And we'll come to that in just a moment. Yeah. And of course, this is the story in theory, which has got the dragons in it.
Yes.
And Alan McKenzie had sort of asked for a dragon story. But yeah, actually, I was struck rereading it this time that the dragons are actually in it quite little, really.
Yes. Yeah, so we're reading about it. He was asked to write a story about dragons, and then he realised that he wasn't particularly interested in the dragons. And so the dragons appear at the beginning. They're very strongly featured in the first episode and then a bit later on, but they're pretty much not involved in the story at all. after that first batch.
And we will mention that he is a human scientist sent to live with a blue-skinned race of aliens in a sort of forest setting.
Sounds familiar.
Yes, corporate raiders are interested in a particular resource that can only be found on this planet. We will come back to that as well.
Yes, I think it sounds interesting. It sounds like something I could make a movie about. But yes, perhaps we'll talk about that a bit later. Yeah.
Let's start with John Smith as a writer. Now, you've mentioned that he was less interested in the dragons. He's more interested in the alien world and in the behaviour of humans.
Yeah.
What do you make of his writing here, and particularly some of the sort of very purple passages of description?
Yes. I mean, John Smith is probably one of my personal favourite writers in 2000 AD. And his writing is more science fiction than fantasy, although it has strong fantasy elements in it, but it seems to be more science fiction than anything else. And Firekind, if you look at what he's done in 2000 AD, there's maybe 8 or 9 major stories in his writing history, he started with some Future Shocks, but his first story was Cinnabar, the Rogue Trooper story. And then, of course, he has Tyranny Rex and Indigo Prime and Revere and then Slaughter Bowl, a story called Leatherjack, which is also written drawn by Paul Marshall. And then, of course, Cradle Grave. And Firekind fits right in the middle of those stories. It's about number 5, I think, in the time where those stories get introduced. So this is possibly like John Smith's middle period. So what he's done with Firekind is that he's kind of taken this kind of middle path where he focuses very strongly on the story, but he decorates the story with his own particular writing style. So if you get a story like, for example, like Revere is like to one extreme. It's very psychedelic and weird, beautifully told story, but you're never quite sure what's going on. But in Firekind, the story is very clear, the plot progression is very clear. But when characters are confused or angry or scared, that's when John Smith moves into his, I guess it's almost like a German style of writing, where he merges and blends lots of words together to create a very disconcepting, sort of disconcerting impression that translates very quickly to the author. It's a very impressive signature style, I think.
It is, yes. And, you know, he does write beautifully about the alien world. I think, as we can tell, he's not that interested in the dragons. Yeah. He's much more interested in the alien species, their world, some of the sort of religious spiritual aspects of their existence on the planet of Genia Leal.
Yes.
And you mentioned you picked out some themes in his work that sort of recur throughout.
Yes. So I think there's some very typical John Smith elements. So, for example, as I said, he's more of a science fiction writer than a fantasy writer. So he's very fond of his techno jargon. There's lots of like a techno jargon in this that don't appear in any other stories. Words like a spit ship and null suit and scientific or pseudo scientific words like the Milinkovitch field, which is the field that I can't remember the word now that they use in Star Trek. He beams down onto the planet.
The transporter.
The transporter field is called the Milinkovitch field, which must be very difficult to spell check when you're looking at his work. But that's aspect, his techno jargon. And as you mentioned, a lot of his work has a very strong religious element. So it's not so much magical like a lot of writers are kind of like they add magic to it to get the fancy elements. John Smith has a lot of religious elements, and these religious elements are very strong in Firekind. Like the one of the major themes is a theme about nature and the presence of something called the All Spirit, which is like the spirit or the soul of the planet, which is a very religious approach to the story. And the one of the underlying themes in Firekind is a fall from grace. So one of the back in history, or perhaps it's like the legend of the local people, that one of their ancestors defied God, and that made their whole race fall from grace and to the state that they're in at the moment. And of course, at the end, the uber bad guy, a guy called Mr. Cheetle, he is obviously the devil. I mean, he's designed by Paul Marshall with hooves, which is a very strong religious element there.
The other thing, of course, I noted particularly on this reading, and it, I think, links us into other sort of science fiction stories, is quite how much Firekind is a sort of representation of and criticism of colonialism and the fact that humans just keep exploiting other cultures for resources.
Yes, certainly the exploitation is hinted very strongly. Even Larson himself is accused of exploiting the villagers that he's studying. I'm not too sure whether it's colonialism, because even the bad guys are not trying to colonize the planet; they're just trying to steal all the resources from it. It's a fine line, perhaps, but they're just looking to smash and grab. I'm not too sure whether it's a colonial, the objective, but certainly the idea that the outside, the human, the white man is better than the native and looks down on the native. That's a very strong theme in Firekind, and soon proven that it's not the case.
And I did wonder whether there were any notes from John Smith to Paul Marshall about Larson's clothing, because he wears a uniform that has certain sort of what we might say sort of imperialistic notes to it. It's a sort of strange outfit that he wears on the planet.
Yeah, so it's bright pink, or at least a scarlet colour. So he does kind of look like a red coat, a British red coat from the 18th or 19th centuries, that you would have seen leading the colonial efforts in Africa. So it's certainly redolent of that. I mean, of course, the natives themselves are not wearing anything or very little, and the bad guys as well as Larson are, well, you'd call them overdressed. So that there is a strong, symbolistic opposite there.
Larson's jacket has a sort of double-breasted front, the high collar. He wears frilly cuffs and a sort of white neckcloth. We were talking before we pressed record about, of course, the work, the epic work from 2008 of Nikolai Dante, and the sort of Russian court clothing, of course, that features throughout there. It's a certain look to it. And I just wonder what were the notes between Smith and Marshall when it came to designing the characters.
Yeah, I mean, Paul Marshall was interviewed in an issue of the magazine about 10 years ago. And he said that he received copious notes from John Smith about the story. So I can only imagine that the uniform and the tight trousers that Larson's wearing are all completely intentional on behalf of the writer.
Now, I've noted that we don't seem to talk about Paul Marshall as a 2000 AD artist enough. He doesn't perhaps get the credit and recognition that he deserves, particularly for a work as beautiful as this. Tell us a little about him as an artist for the prog and on this particular story.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult, actually. Paul Marshall is a genuine hero of 2000 AD. He's number 43 in the Heroes of 2000 AD blog. And he's been in, he's written, drawn many stories in 2000 AD and a wide range as well. And his style has changed a great deal from the beginning. Firekind was his first long-running story. He says that he found it very difficult because of it, the amount of time it took to draw. And that's probably why most of his stories are short in duration, one-offs or two or three parters. And that's probably why, he's not talked about very much, because he doesn't have like a signature standout long-form story. Incidentally, in that episode, so in the issue of the magazine, where he's interviewed, I think it's in 2013, one of his stories debuts in an issue, which is a story featuring Judge Francisco, the former chief judge. And it's a wonderfully named story called The Streets of Dan Francisco. And that is incredibly well drawn. It's colored, I think, by the same colorist that does Nicolai Dante. So there's another link there. But it's quite a wonderfully drawn story. And I mean, on his Blogspot page, there's lots of examples of his art, and his covers as well are quite wonderful. And one in particular, again going back to Nicolai Dante, he did a cover of Lulu. Walking towards the reader with her arms outstretched, with a sinister smile on her face, with her open mouth behind her, some sort of a background, and her demons flying out of her hands. Black, white, and red cover. It's extremely eye-catching. It's Prog 1654, I think, and it's quite a stunning front cover.
And he's painting here on Firekind, beautiful yes. painted work.
Yes.
Particularly on obviously stuff that's going to lean in to John Smith's hallucinatory psychedelic language, particularly when Larson has to remove the mask and breathe in the hallucinogenic pollens and so on.
Yes, yes, yes.
What do you make about Paul Marshall's work on this story?
Well, I think it's incredible, and one of the important elements of the story is the contrast it throws up. There's lots of contrasts which create a tension in the story, and one of these major contrasts is between nature and machines, so the natural and the mechanical, and that's very clear in John Smith's writing, but it's also very clear in the art. And one of the remarkable piece of art is I'm just looking for the page now, but when towards the end of the story, where the bad guys are smugglers are trying to hunt down Larson and his village of friends, they send a machine after him. In the digital edition, it's page 65 on the bottom page numbers. I think it's called a mover graver. So it moves, yes. It moves, and it sends people to their graves, I guess. And it's black and shiny, and it's drawn in the forest. So everything is beautifully rendered behind it, like flowers and trees, and you've got this mechanical, shiny, robotic, evil thing dominating the page. And that's exactly that, right? That page there. And it's jarring because the ship is drawn so beautifully, and the nature is drawn so beautifully, and the combination of the two is quite a shock.
I noticed in your notes about Paul Marshall that you saw comparisons in his early work with Steve Dillon.
Yes, yeah.
Appropriate enough because he worked on Tyranny Rex as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, these are all personal opinions. I don't know what you think, but if you look at the page before the Mover Graver appears at the bottom, you've got Mr. Cheetle. I think no, not Mr. Cheetle. It's the Archduke, the boss bad man. And in the faces, the characters, I see very strong Steve Dillon influence. And I mean, I wonder whether some of the notes from John Smith were perhaps to look at the way that Steve Dillon draws people, because I know there's a strong connection between John Smith and Steve Dillon. Steve Dillon drew Cinnabar. So. You know, I think perhaps that's one of John Smith's favourite types of artist, perhaps.
I see. I mean, particularly not in here, but in Paul Marshall's more recent work for 2000 AD and the Meg, I've seen quite a lot of Colin McNeill influence.
Yes, recent Colin McNeill. Yeah.
Yeah, this painted work is, I think, my favourite that I've seen of Paul Marshall's. It is just wonderful. I mean, I noted particularly when Larson is being tortured, spoilers, there's a torture sequence.
Yes.
There was a couple of panels where I thought the anatomy was slightly off, but the representation of the sort of the forest setting, the alien setting, as you've said, the beautiful combinations of machinery and alien environment is just wonderful. It's just absolutely great to look at.
Yeah. I mean, it's fully painted art. I think it's all manually drawn, this one. And later on, it's clearly he's moved on to computer art, I think. I mean, for example, like as I said, the streets of San Francisco is, I think, clearly computer drawn. And his style has evolved. Probably become less complicated and more simple in his style. Probably, like for example, his recent work on Skip Tracer. I think that was Paul Marshall. That's a far simpler style to the style in Firekind. Probably bowing to the pressures of a long form story that has to come out every week.
So you mentioned a long form story. It does read brilliantly as a 12-parter, as it were, or rather, if you put all 12 parts together.
Yeah.
5 to 6 pages per issue. I noted in my notes that it's quite strange that there's not an awful lot happening in the first four episodes. And then, of course, the story accelerates in the second half when all the bad stuff starts happening. We wanted to mention editorial because there's a couple of things people remember about Firekind. I guess they remember dragons, although as you say, it's not really a dragon story.
No,
we're going to mention a famous movie in a few moments, but before we get to that, what about at least one error that was made with the printing of Firekind?
Well, I'm going to throw in another error as a bonus. The introduction, the editor's note to the Extreme edition, Alan Barnes, who was the editor of the magazine at the time, who was editing this Extreme edition as well, he calls it a bona fide lost classic. So, I mean, even fairly soon after its publication, it's considered a lost classic. And I think it's something that fell between the cracks, especially possibly even with the editors themselves. I mean, it's not particularly important, but in episode 2, for example, there's a spelling mistake in the text. Perhaps it's very difficult to spell check John Smith's work with all the techno jargon that he adds. But I was quite surprised to see that that had slipped past editorial, and then famously, of course, they printed it and skipped a whole episode. So episode 7 of the story was skipped. They went straight from episode 6 to episode 8. And they say quite disingenuously that no one noticed. Suggesting that the story was quite complicated and people couldn't follow it. But of course, episode 7, the one that they missed out, is probably the most important episode of the whole lot, because it tells you what happens. You skip from 6 to 8 and suddenly you're like, what's going on? What's happened? You know, episode 7 is probably the most important episode in the whole run, apart from, you know, the end episode. And I can't believe that an editor would do something like that. I mean, how do you miss out an episode? I mean, what on earth happened? I can't imagine happening today. But I'd like to find out why that happened.
Yes, because episode 7 is where the bad guys turn up.
Yes. The bad guys turn up, and of course, you know, if you followed the story, the whole point of the story is that the atmosphere of this planet is poisonous, and that when Larsen removes his mask, he has a psychedelic break where the pollen poisons him, and he somehow gets through the other side with enhanced mental powers. And, that's considered fairly miraculous. And, of course, in episode 7, when all the bad guys turn up, none of them have any masks on. And it's like, surely, you know, the editor should have picked that up, but they didn't.
Hmm. Yes, I was puzzled by the lack of masks in the second part of the story when they were such a big thing in the first part of the story.
Yes, there's four of them. There's four bad guys that appear out of nowhere. And they've got guns, but no masks. And there's no reference to why they don't have masks in it.
And then episode 7, if I'm right in thinking, was printed in the prog at the very end of the run.
Yes, it's by the way, this is the episode that we missed. Ha ha ha, kind of laughing about it.
At least by 2005, they were able to put it right in the extreme edition.
Yes.
And we've got that. And as you say, Alan Barnes quite rightly calling it a lost classic, and one that was perhaps slightly poorly treated in the prog at the time as well.
Yes. I mean, one of the reasons why this story stood out to me so much, because, I mean, I read it all in one go and thought this is an incredible story, was that it's an extremely difficult time for 2000. This is 1993. There's a dearth of good stories. This is probably the nadir of the whole history of the prog. Give an example, this Feierkind started in prog 828, and 828 is actually quite a good prog. It's a jumping on prog. It's got good stories in there. But 827, the prog before, has Robo Hunter, written by Alan McKenzie. It's got a one-shot Garth Ennis Judge Dredd. It's got a Future Shock, drawn by Ron Smith, but it's not a particularly standout story. And it has Kelly's Eye in it, which is, in my opinion, I love 1970s comic stories, Kelly's Eye is probably the worst thing ever to grace the pages of 2000 AD. And yes, so those four stories, it's Robo Hunter, Judge Dredd, Kelly's Eye, and Bradley to finish off. Again, Alan McKenzie. So, these are, quite frankly, it's a very poor lineup. And then suddenly 828, you get Feierkind. Armored Gideon appears in 828, and you have the return of Bad Company with Kano in 828. So it stood out for this prog and this story being not only very good in its own right, but so much better than what had come before.
A quick note about reproduction. The Extreme Edition, of course, is large format. It's got some nice paper. You noted that the colours compared to the digital edition that we've both got as well, there's a slight change, isn't there?
Yeah, it seems like the digital edition is a scan of the in some form. The Extreme Edition is large. It's larger than the digital edition. But the colours are far deeper and richer in the digital edition, and they really pop off the screen, and it's quite an impressive reproduction and recovery that they've done. I mean, I'd love to know what actually they did, because it's quite wonderful.
Influences on Firekind, and then Firekind's influences on other works.
Yeah.
Obviously, John Smith, I think, in himself, has drawn from quite a number of science fiction and fantasy sources.
Yes, yes. I mean, the clearest influence, I think, of course, is Dune. And I mean, obviously, you've got the two main themes there. First of all, you've got the sandworms in Dune and the Kashyyyk dragons in Firekind, both of which are responsible for producing a mind-altering, life-extending drug. And then you've got the inhospitable environment. In Dune, obviously, people have to wear masks and sand suits. And in this planet in Firekind, they have to wear, you know, masks against the pollen. So you've got that influence, and of course it's not really talked about a lot in Firekind. But Larsen develops psi powers. You know, he can see a bit of the future. He can talk via his mind to the native inhabitants after his exposure to the pollen, which is obviously reflecting Dune as well. I also think that the structure of Firekind is similar to Dune. I mean, they split the films of Dune into two. It was quite a natural break. The book of Dune, the first half is very much world building, and then the second half is all fighting and violence and action. And the same is true in Firekind. Yeah, so I think that's the main influence. And there's also mentioned that, especially the dragons and the forest, the natural items in Firekind are influenced by Ursula Le Guin. Especially in a book called "The Word for World is Forest," which has some very similar themes to Firekind, but a very different story.
And you mentioned that Larsen gains a sort of psychic connection to the Genyans and to their sort of world consciousness. And of course, people who haven't read Firekind might be thinking, well, there's another story about blue-skinned aliens who live in a forest world with hallucinogenic, toxic pollens, and who are connected to a sort of worldwide neural net, and then humans come to get a rare resource from that planet, which I believe goes by the daft name of unobtainium in the film.
Yes, yes.
Because a famous filmmaker wrote a script the year after this comic, didn't he?
Yeah, so in 1994, James Cameron wrote his... it was an 80-page treatment for what became Avatar. I mean, since then, Avatar is, I think, it's officially the most popular film in film history. You know, it has earned the most money, and it's extremely popular all over the world. It's become like a behemoth. So if you look at you go back to the 2080 forum, people are accusing Firekind of being a rip-off of Avatar, when actually in chronological order, Firekind comes before Avatar. And there's so many similarities between Firekind and Avatar that it's very tempting to say that James Cameron read Firekind and just stole the whole thing. And you've got the blue natives, you've got the hostile planet, you've got people wearing masks, you've got flying dragons, which are an important episode in Avatar, and also you've got floating mountains.
Yes.
One of the important themes in Firekind, of course, is that the whole planet is is an intrinsic whole, and everything is interlinked with each other, and controlled by the all spirit, God of the planet. And there are floating rocks just drifting through the atmosphere in the planet in Firekind, that are important at the end of the story. In Avatar as well, you have floating mountains, which seems to be completely ripped off. You know, I don't know. Have you seen Avatar?
Well, I have a confession to make. I've never seen either Titanic or Avatar or the Avatar sequel. So, no.
Well, I think it's something we could do for the Megacity Film Club as well, if you're interested. You know, I wouldn't like to spoil any future comments about the film, but I suffered through Avatar, and right. I certainly would never watch anything else related to it. The reason why I wouldn't say Avatar is a ripoff of Firekind, although it's very tempting, is because if he did steal from Firekind, he's stolen all the things from the surface, and he's not stolen the important things. He's not stolen, for example, an interesting plot. He's not stolen complex characters. He's not stolen the tension that John Smith and Paul Marshall create in this story. You know, Avatar is such a linear plot. You know, things move from A to B to C to D, and you can see it coming a mile off. And Avatar, I mean, I don't want to. I mean, it's so popular, and so many people like it. That perhaps the problem here is me, not the film. But it seems to me that what's happened is that James Cameron and John Smith have borrowed from similar sources and come up with similar conclusions. Because
drunk at similar wells.
Because if you say like, Avatar, it's just ripped Firekind off. If that was the case, you would never read Firekind, because you'd be like, oh, it's just Avatar. But it's so much better than that I'm almost going the other way. I want to sever the link between the two, although the link is far too strong to do that. But
Firekind by John Smith and Paul Marshall was a delight that I was really looking forward to tackling, and I'm very glad to have had a chance to read the whole thing in the correct order. It is, I think it's a splendid story, actually. It was one of the highlights of this period of 2000 AD.
Yes.
And I think Alan Barnes is quite right. And I also note Luke Williams on the Everything Comes Back to 2000 AD site also calling it a sort of lost classic from this from the 1990s.
Yes. Yes, no, I completely agree. I think it's wonderful.
Let us get to away from the subject of influences, both on the story and from the story. Let's talk about something slightly easier and do Grail pages.
Right.
Now, you've picked out a couple of images from this story that you'd like to own if we could get the original art.
Yes. Well, the whole thing is so beautifully drawn, so beautifully story told, and so beautifully coloured. You could pick any page. I mean, I'd love any page from this. But if you do look at the digital edition, and this is a page that you can see in the preview because it's the second page of the whole story. You start off on the first page and you've got lots of very small panels. And it's you're seeing Larson being transported onto the surface of the planet, actually onto one of the floating rocks around the planet. And then you turn the page and suddenly, bam, massive dragon coming straight towards you. It's such a powerful page. You can see the wind moving in Larson's hair. The dragon's got his mouth open and you think he's going to eat Larson. That's going to be a short story. it flies overhead onto page three, and it's such a stunning, shocking start to the story.
It's a wonderful page. Full page splash by Paul Marshall. Literally, here be a dragon. And you look like, as you say, Larson's going to not be very long for this story. But fortunately, he survives.
Yes. And that grabs you right from the beginning. And my second page is interesting because it shows the... you know, the storytelling and the power of religion and the influence of religion in the story. It's a page towards the middle of the story where Larsen has lost his mask and he's exposed to the pollen and he thinks he's going to die. And he sees himself as Saint Sebastian, which, you know, is a very important saint. It comes up quite a lot, often in quite erotic stories. For example, it's very important to the Japanese novelist Yukio Mishima, who was a very troubled, very interesting artist, who had himself photographed as Saint Sebastian. In his biography, you can see the photographs that were taken. And this is somewhat problematic because, of course, Saint Sebastian was a Roman centurion, I believe, a soldier, who was he became a saint, a martyr, by being tied to a tree and having arrows fired into him. So you can see almost naked form, muscular naked form of Saint Sebastian with lots of arrows sticking out of him on this page. And he blesses Larsen, forgives him for his sins. And then Larsen lays down. One of the joys of Paul Marshall's art in this whole story is it's so kinetic. It's moving. Everything is thrusting and pouring from the page. And then in the bottom half of this particular page, everything stops. Because Larsen thinks he's dying. And he melts into the undergrowth without his mask on. And the colours disappear. And Larsen turns into a paint-by-numbers page. And in his head, he's counting down he's going under, in an operation. And he's counting 10, 9, 8, and he gets to 7, and he disappears. And it's such an incredible 8-panel page of storytelling that I don't think I've seen anything like it.
It's a wonderful page. Page 38 in the digital edition, I believe.
Yeah.
As literally everything is subtracted from Larsen as he fades to black.
Yes.
Marvellous work on that page by Paul Marshall and great writing by John Smith. I mean, you've got it all on that page. Smith's prose, Paul Marshall absolutely at the best of his of his talents. Wonderful stuff.
Yes. How about you, Eamon?
Well, I'm going to nip back 4 pages from that in the digital edition to page 34. And Larsen is walking along a beach. His mask is failing. He's starting to have the first hallucinogenic moments of what's going to be his sort of psychedelic experience or psychedelic break, as you described it. And it's just, again, beautiful use of colours by Paul Marshall, beautiful use of description of the various weird creatures on this seashore. I love a panel which gives you a close-up of an eye,
yes,
the human eye. And again, Paul Marshall doing that extremely well in the top right-hand corner of this page.
Yes.
We've got some of the floating stones in the background. So, yeah, I really love that one. And as ever, I will post all these images on all the various social medias for the podcast when this episode comes out so people can see what we've been talking about with some of this wonderful artwork and the words that go with them.
Yeah, and I'd just like to add something about that page. I mean, it's a wonderful page. I mean, it's ethereal. He's still got like a few hours left. He's not yet dead. He's not yet resigned himself to his fate. And then suddenly the last panel, thin fourth panel, and it's like, I run out of beach. And it's like, suddenly it's like, oh, shit. What's happening next. And it leads on to you've got 2 pages of him struggling and fighting and finally giving up and melting into the undergrowth.
Wonderful stuff. What a story, Firekind. Yeah. I'm so glad we finally got to it and tackled it. Yeah, great stuff, Ashley. Thank you for picking it.
Oh, no, wonderful.
I will say that you can find it in Extreme Edition number 8 from 2005. It's in the Ultimate Collection 82 hardback, which was from 2020. Currently digitally available from 2000 AD for $7.99. It's even cheaper on the Kindle, although, of course, there you've not got... it's not digital rights free, whereas the 2000 AD stuff is DRM free.
Yes.
But the digital edition, I think, is also very nice as well. Very crisp and sharp. A certain brightness to the colours. And notably, of course, they're all in the right order.
Yes, very important.
Fantastic stuff. Well, that is Firekind. We've knocked it off, Ashley. Well done.
Yes, yeah. There's so much else I would like to talk about. There's so many other things in it. But perhaps another time.
Yeah, well, we may be returning to this subject. Ashley Baker will return in an episode of Mega City Film Club at some point.
Yes,
and we talk about
I'd love to,
other side of the equation, perhaps. I might have to watch the Blue Aliens film.
Yes.
Now, like I said in the start, you are in Japan, where I believe you're working as a translator. How did you end up living and working in Japan, Ashley?
Well, I studied as an undergraduate Japanese, I came to Japan to try and use the language that I'd learned. And this was back in 1993. I came to Japan, so 31 years ago now. And apart from a couple of years when I came back to the UK to get my master's degree in translation, I've stayed here ever since. My whole life I've lived in Japan since, the age of 21 or so. I work for a large company doing translation and interpreting. I spend my days writing and speaking.
And one of the things we envy about Japan and Japanese culture, of course, is their huge range of comics that are so popular.
Yeah.
Do you get a chance to enjoy some of those as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my family, my wife and children love manga, and the house is full. We had our spare bedroom. We took all the beds out and converted it into a library. It's not the room I'm in at the moment, but the whole room is dedicated to manga. It's wall to floor to ceiling manga. The children's bedrooms as well, wall to wall, ceiling to floor manga. Of course, I mean, there's manga for everything, whatever type of story that you would like. And, you go into any bookshop in Japan, it's one third novels, and the rest is manga. From the youngest children to the oldest adult, is something for you. It's quite impressive.
Fantastic. Well, maybe we will at some point get some manga on this on the podcast here as well.
Yeah.
You also wanted to mention your wife, because your wife's a translator as well, is that right?
Well, she's not a full-time translator, but she has a very good English skills. And recently, just a few months ago, she started up her own translation company she's looking for customers. She has quite an extensive experience, from manga to medicine. That if anybody is interested in having something translated into out of Japanese, please send me an email.
And look in the show notes for this episode or on the website megacitybookclub.com, and you'll find a link to Ashley's wife's translation service company. Very good. Yes. Well, fantastic, Ashley. Thank you for giving up your time on this Saturday evening for you, Saturday morning for me. We've talked about one of the John Smith greats, but also a Paul Marshall great as well.
Yes.
If you've never read Firekind, I think you should track it down, because it really is highly recommended.
Yes, it's a wonderful story.
Great stuff. And as I say, Ashley Baker will return in Mega City Film Club with Conrad, hopefully.
Yes, that'd be fun.
And thank you to everyone for listening to Megacity Book Club. As ever, find all of these links that we've mentioned at megacitybookclub.com. Follow the pod on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, Mastodon, Blue Sky, and a new social media platform called Milinkovic Field, where you will see all the images we've been talking about. Email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com, as Ashley did, if you want to come on the show yourself. And until next time, when we're passing judgment on another great book, it's a goodbye from me and...
It's a goodbye from me.